All righty, and let's give a rousing Tulare County welcome for our warm-up speaker, Albert.
Thank you. My name is Albert, and I'm an alcoholic. And I'm a proud member of Alcoholics Anonymous and a proud product of Pine Recovery. That's where I got sober April the 8th, 1989. Yeah. Hey, first and foremost, before I forget, I had to write a couple of things down because you remember that commercially that I'm falling and I can't get up?
Yeah.
Well, when I start talking, I get into that I'm talking and I can't shut up thing. So I had to write a few things down so I'll know, okay, shut up now, man. And I do this when I come here and I have to read. These are my alumni brother's wife's glasses. You saw her pass them to me. This keeps me humble. It's kind of hard to come up here and act hard wearing my sister's glasses. Eh? So, all right? So now that I got that out of the way, I want to wish all of you a very blessed Good Friday. And I think about it, man. We just came from that, what was that at? Crowd dance or something? Yeah, and I'm thinking it is a Good Friday, man. I'm above ground. I'm sober, you know. I have the most amazing family and friends anyone can ever have. I'm overfed. Good Friday, heck, it don't get any gooder than that, man. Not to mention TGIF, thank God Unforgiven, you know what I mean? When I look back and think about all the things that were unforgivable and all the things that I've done that made me feel for so many years that I didn't deserve what you people had. And then you people taught me how you got it and showed me that I'm also just as deserving as you are. So I started thinking, man, wow, what a trip, eh? You know? And those of you that know me, I've been saying this for a while because it makes a lot of sense to me. I've come to believe in my own way that we're all God's kids, man. We're all God's kids. But I gotta tell you, man, sometimes I just feel like I'm his favorite, you know what I mean? Because when I look at how my life has been the past 28 years, you know, and, shout out to all the April babies, Catherine, Larry, and anyone that's celebrating in April, man. When I look back at all the stuff that has happened, and this one word comes to mind, serendipity. That's my favorite word, eh? Because I remember I would first come to the meetings and people would say the serenity prayer. And I didn't even know what serenity meant, you know what I mean? Growing up in the barrio in Cutler, you know, I've never heard that kind of language before, man. And I looked up that word and it said a feeling within oneself. Right under it was another word and it said serendipity. And that's my favorite word. It says, it means to find something delightful purely by accident. To find something delightful purely by accident. And think about it, man. This is a trip, eh? Back in 89, when my parole officer sent me to the meetings to get my card signed, I like didn't want to come, eh? This is one place, especially on a Friday night in the AA meeting. I mean, like, come on, man. What would the fellas think? You know what I mean? What are you going to do this Friday? Well, I'm going to go to a meeting, home. So you're going to, what? You know, it's like, no. And, you know, this thing saved my life. Well, no, that's not true. I take that back. It gave me a life. Alcoholics Anonymous, it gave me a life. I would hear people talk about how this program saved their life. And I'm sure that for them it did. Mine was, I was on that road to destruction, you know what I mean? The 8 DUIs, the 5 high pursuit chases, strong arm robberies, man, and burglaries, and, you know, heck, being shot at, gang banging, and all that stupid stuff that I did before I got here. I never knew I was going to live to be 54, man. And coming here was the one thing that I didn't want to do, man, no matter what. And it's the best thing that ever happened to me. Alcoholics Anonymous. But I gotta say this, eh? Alcoholics Anonymous wouldn't be Alcoholics Anonymous if it wasn't for the people that were here when I got here. The examples. I'm not talking about the ones that, you know, come in and out and talk out of the side of their necks. I'm talking about the ones that don't just talk the talk, but walk the walk, and then they live it, and then they're the example. You know, those were the ones that taught me and showed me, man. You know, and they gave me hope, eh? And then I see Jack, man, and it's a trip because, it's people that were here that don't even know me, man. And I didn't know them. And back in the day, you think, man, I don't want to know these people. But they see someone in you that you don't even know exists within yourself. And then they help you bring it out. I love Roland, man. That dude, I remember when he first got here, you could see this dude was on fire, man. Like somebody lit a match under his foot or something, because he just came in with this, I want this thing. And I love that because it reminds me. I didn't know if I wanted what you had when I got here. But I knew I didn't want what I had anymore, eh? I didn't want it, man. You know, I wanted to die, man. I didn't even want to live anymore, man. But see, I'm such a coward. I'm not the suicide type, eh? You know what I mean? I'd rather do a drive-by or a hyperspeed chase, maybe go off something stupid like that. You know what I mean? So at least you'll come out in the paper or something. You know what I mean? But to do myself, man, it's like I'm just not that kind of guy. You know what I mean? But there's so many people. I see faces. And some I've known for a lot of years that were here when I got here. And I see faces of people that I've had the privilege of going through Pine with, and people that have come in afterwards, and they stick around, man, no matter what. And I see you guys go through some stuff, man, hard stuff, eh? And we stay sober, eh? We stay sober. That's an awesome thing, huh? Okay, before I get off track here, oh yeah, you know, the reason I always say that I'm a proud member of Alcoholics Anonymous is not because I don't drink. You know, and I don't like that greeting where they say, oh, for those of you that can turn around and drink like a gentleman, our hats are off to you. Yeah, right. If you could turn around and drink like a gentleman, my mind says, I want to stick you in the neck with an ice pick, man, because I'll copper resentment towards somebody like you, you know? And I don't know, maybe that's just the alcoholic thinking, you know? But you're an alcoholic. You guys are laughing. You think the same thing. And the ones that aren't laughing act like they don't. You know what I mean? But I got to tell you, the reason that I say I'm a proud member and I'm blessed and I feel sometimes like I'm one of God's favorites, because it's not because I haven't drank in 28 years, eh? That's not why. It's because the way this program and what I've been taught has changed my life in the past 28 years. You know, I know for a fact, you know, if I'm doing what I'm supposed to be doing, this is a trip, man. Look around. I have some of the best friends in this room tonight that have been there by my side, eh? Have gone out of their way and above and beyond the call of duty for me. And I'm like, who am I, eh? I ain't nobody. I'm just a messy pants wino, man, that don't drink. I'm just a greasy, like a slice of bacon dope fiend that don't use. I'm a liar, I'm a thief, I'm a whore. I'm an ex-convict, former gangbanger. And I haven't done none of that crap in over 28 years. And it's all because of you people, eh? It's all because of you. And to think, this is the one thing that I didn't want, man. How stupid is that, eh? You know what I mean? The one thing I didn't want. I guess that's what makes me an alcoholic and a dope fiend. The one thing that's good, I don't want it. You know how we want stuff that's not good for us? You know, like tacos and stuff like that? You know? We always want something that's not good for us, man. I don't know. I gotta tell you, since I've been here, and it's just life. I heard a guy say one time, had I known I was going to live this long, I probably would have taken better care of myself, right? Well, I should have taken that dude's advice like 28 years ago, man. But since I've been sober, This is a trip. And I'm not complaining, I'm not whining, so don't offer me any cheese, eh? So, I've had 3 heart attacks, Matt. A stroke, and I didn't stay paralyzed. A 5 artery bypass open heart surgery. 2 years ago this month, you know, I lost both my legs. And Catherine and David know, just this month, I've been in Kauai Delta for 3 weeks out of the last month. I was in ICU for 14 days. I was on oxygen for 3 days. I was on life support for 2 days. And I'm kicking back here, man. And last month, you guys had Britta. And man, I love that gal. I've seen her come in, and I've seen her grow. And she's beautiful, man. She's an amazing young lady, just like her sponsor, man. And I go, the ambulance comes and picks me up on a Thursday, takes me to the ER, man. And I'm there in ER, and they put me on this oxygen machine, and they're trying to keep me going because I can't breathe. And I'm frustrated with this thing on my head, and I can't breathe, and I'm getting angry. And then I realize, oh, darn, it's Friday. That's right. Britta's speaking in Tulare, and I'm going to miss it. That sucks. See, even when you're dying, eh, you still think of others. You know what I mean? That's how I know this program works. Because I don't think of others, eh? All I've ever thought of was my selfish, self-centered self, man. And when I kick back and I start thinking of you and Jim and all these people, I'm thinking, man, this program really works, eh? So I'm kicking back, and then I'm laying in bed, and everything's going fuzzy, and I can't see nothing. And there's like 5 or 7 people standing around my bed, and there's one dude standing next to me, man. He says, I'm Dr. So-and-so, man, and do you trust me? And I got trust issues, eh? He says, do you trust me to do anything possible within my means to save your life, man? I looked at him, and I can't see nothing, and I'm like, what are you talking about? Just call my sister, right? That's all you got to do. And he said, I'll call your sister, but do you trust me to save your life? I said, do whatever you got to do, man. And then I don't remember anything afterwards. And then 2.5 days later, I wake up, and my sister is right there holding my hand, kissing my forehead, you know. And I started crying, eh? Some of you know my sister. And she's old school, man. She's hard, eh? But I opened my eyes, and she's there, and she's crying. And I couldn't help but cry, eh? Because Alcoholics Anonymous, there was a time when I wanted to die. You know, wreck in a high pursuit chase, or get shot at during a drive-by, or something, maybe OD on heroin, I don't know. There was a time when I wanted to die. This program gave me a will to live, eh? And I remember, it's a trip, because 3 times I've been put out by a doctor, and every time they put me out, man, they always said something like, well, you know, when we put you out, man, you might not wake up, eh? I said, hey, don't trip, man. Your job as a doctor is to tell me what you're going to do and what could happen. My job as a patient is just to make the decision and say, orale, go ahead and do it, eh? But the reason I'm not worried about it, because his job is to decide whether I wake up or not. You see, I believe that I'm one of God's favorites. Because for so many years I was rotten, mean, hateful, violent, ugly. And I'm not saying I'm not ugly now, but I'm just saying I was uglier then, you know what I mean? But it ain't like that no more. People, when I first got here, I used to think like, man, I don't want them to get to know me, because once all these people start to get to know me and stuff, they're not going to want anything to do with me. And in these rooms, the exact opposite. Mike got me involved in service, took me out of town, you know, stopped in Fresno, wherever they go, you know. It made me feel part of, and I didn't even feel worthy of, you know what I mean? Imagine that, huh? Isn't that a trip? Okay, the last thing, because I'm looking at the clock, and I told you I get long-winded. Oh yeah, all you guys that are my age and older, man, don't give yourselves away. I'm just saying, all of you guys that are my age and older, one of my favorite shows, man, when I was full, Beretta and Perry Mason. Hey, remember Perry Mason? Okay. If you know the show, in your head, you know the theme song to the TV show Perry Mason, right? I gotta tell you, man, I celebrate with Catherine and I celebrate with Larry, man. And I love Larry. To me, it's a privilege to be this guy's warm-up speaker. He's become a dear friend, you know, and he's come to visit me in my home. He's taken me to meetings, you know. He's talk about a group of people who ordinarily wouldn't mix. Look at us, eh? You know what I mean? And then he comes and picks me up, man. And we're getting ready to leave, and he's looking at me kind of funny. And I grab my hat and I throw it on. And I get my glasses and I put them on. He goes, "Now that's the Albert I know. Let's go now, man." All right. So when my sponsor Rick introduces Larry, and Larry's walking up here, silently in your head, when you look at him, sing the Perry Mason song to yourself, okay? Okay? Thank you. God bless you. Oh, and I hope all of you have a blessed Resurrection Day this Sunday.
Alrighty, let's give a warm to Larry Canny welcome for our featured speaker, Larry.
Good evening, my name is Larry and I am an alcoholic. And I see a lot of familiar faces out there, and I'm grateful for that. But it's also very dangerous for my ego, so bear with me. I was, you know, when you get notice of doing these things, you know, it kind of gets into your head for a while. Well, what can I talk about? And it goes on and on and on and on. And I think Kurt and I were talking about that at one point. And he's right. I mean, it does. And so I was talking to another friend of ours, Anthony. I don't see him tonight, but him and Michelle. But anyway, Anthony. And I said, well, you know, I'd really like to do something different. And, you know, but what is the most favorite thing that alcoholics really enjoy doing? And I said, I know, gossip and character assassination. So I thought maybe we'd just change it up tonight. What do you think? Then Catherine cornered me, and she wanted me to just let everybody know that if it wasn't for her, I wouldn't be standing here. And once again, it's all about her, you know.
That's right.
I did want to say something about Albert, and I'm grateful and privileged and honored that he was my warm-up speaker tonight. After all the things that Albert has been through, there's a light that shines through. And the truth of it is if it wasn't for this program, that light wouldn't be there. So I'm privileged and honored to call you friend, and I'm grateful you were here, Albert. Thank you very much. To tell my story, I came into Alcoholics Anonymous April 9th, 1976. I was 2 years old. All right, I was a little more than two. The fact of the matter is I was 24 years old, but where I had come from was this. I grew up in a blue-collar family, and there's probably a lot of people that grew up in blue-collar families. And our folks worked in the trades. You know, they were cabinet makers or woodworkers or steel workers, or my dad was a tool and die and template maker. You know, basically these were the things that the people did in our neighborhood. And during the 50s, you know, there was Little League baseball and football and basketball and school intramural sports and all of these things I participated in at that time. But like most blue-collar families of that era in our village, everybody was pretty much drinking. Diets were big for women back then. I don't know if they are today or not. But the doctors used to prescribe these little pills, these what they used to call diet pills. And they had X's in them. The women lost a lot of weight, and they did a lot of housework. And if they wanted to sleep, they drank a lot of booze. And what I'm leading to is that the booze was always available in the house. I started drinking when I was probably about 11 years old. I mean, seriously drinking. And other dry goods were being introduced at that time. Keep in mind, this is the 50s, 60s. And, you know, there was a... It was that era of tune in, turn on, drop out. But Timothy Leary is dead now, and I just wanted to remind people of that. The fact of the matter is that, you know, that this is what was going on. This is how I grew up. And by the time I was 17, I was drinking pretty much daily, and it was always available. It was available in the house. And I quit getting what you would normally term as a hangover. I would, you know, the head was a little fuzzy and you always needed a hair of the dog. And so that was always available. And if it wasn't always available, something else was. And then the other stuff became available. Alcohol was my drug of choice. Not that I didn't participate in the other ones, okay, especially when they were free. But alcohol was my drug of choice. I liked the taste of it. I liked the effect of it. I always did. I did as a little kid. They were giving me sips of beer and wine and shots of whiskey when I was 5 years old. And this was on and off. This is what was happening. So by the time I was 11, I mean, you know, it was a natural progression. By the time I was 17, I wasn't really getting sick. I just needed that one shot to get me going or whatever. And usually I was going to school and working and doing those types of things. Jim wanted me to tell you a story about my youth. When I was a teenager, there was a rock and roll group that was playing at, sorry Tommy, Dodger Stadium. And I bought tickets for it. And in Southern California, and that's where I grew up, you know, the tickets were $6, I think, at the time. And I was sitting on third base line, and the stage was out on second base from left field to right field and out to center field. And it was the Beatles. And there were three rock stations in the SoCal area at the time. They were all AM stations. It was KHJ, KRLA, and KFWB. And you see the weird stuff that you remember, you know, the trivial crap that you remember in your head. You know, I remember those call letters. And KRLA was actually a sponsor of this concert at that time. And I remember getting there, and they had the little, you know, first bands, and, you know, they did their thing. But I remember the guy standing up to the microphone, and he went, "And now KRLA presents the beat." And that's the last thing I heard. KRLA presents the beat. And I did not hear a note of music. There were four guys out on the stage. They might have been the Beatles. They could have been the Beatles. I don't know. I felt like I got robbed of $6, but I had a flask. So I consoled myself and the girl with me. Anyway, we couldn't hear a note. And the screams and the loud, oh, in Dodger Stadium of all places, you know. My God, and I said, nah, that's the last concert I'll ever go to. 1972, I'm in college and I meet this stunning, beautiful girl. Why is it we do these things? I don't know. And I said, guess what? The Moody Blues are in town. I'll get us some tickets. And she said, okay. And I said, hot damn, Daddy, I'm going to have fun tonight. And the Moody Blues was a lot of you know about the group. You know, they're very, they have classical music with rock and roll mixed together, and it's beautiful stuff. But I was introduced to them in 1967 in a haze of hash. And anyway, the fact of the matter is that I had always enjoyed them anyway, just listening to the music. It was at Long Beach Arena. I'll never forget that. So we drove to Long Beach Arena, and we're sitting there waiting for him to come on, and the guy comes out, and he says, now, all of you people, shut up out there. This isn't Black Sabbath. This is the Moody Blues. And the lights went down, and all of a sudden, you saw nothing but lighters everywhere. And the next thing, and I brought booze with me, of course, you know, because while you're listening to music, you have to have some sort of refreshment. And the next thing I know, I'm getting tapped on my shoulder. Well, here's a roach, you know. And then, oh, here comes a Boda bag, you know, this way. And it's got wine in it. And a few minutes later, here's a pipe, you know. Here's a bottle, you know. Take a swig out of that. I mean, you're taking hits off all of this stuff. The next thing I know, here's a damn bong. I'm going, how the hell do you get a bong into this? Needless to say, I went out of there horizontal. Oh, did I impress her? The stupid stuff we did as children, you know. The fact of the matter is, by the time I was 21, I was drinking pretty regularly. And I say that, and the story is probably too long to go into, the reasons why. It was all real stupid. I had just gotten off work. There was three of us. There was three fists sitting on the counter. And he said, none of us are going home until they're done. Like I said, stupid stuff. It was kind of one of those dare things. And so I said, okay, I got to work early tomorrow. And I sucked the bottle down. And I said, now I got to go home. And they're going, no, you can't drive. I said, sure I can drive. I'm fine enough to drive. And this was in Fullerton, California. Well, it was actually Fullerton, La Habra. Across the street was La Habra, and across the street was Fullerton. I worked in Fullerton. They lived in La Habra. It was a weird thing. Anyway, all the cities there finger into each other. It's just stupid. It's like Tennessee and Virginia, you know, Virginia Sea or whatever it is. Anyway, I jump in my... I had this hopped-up little Volkswagen. And nice, you know... two-barrel Weber 1700. It said 1300 on the back. It was lowered in the front. I had 13-inch tires on it, 15s on the back. Gearheads know what I'm talking about. This was my baby, you know. And that thing was smoking hot out on the street. It really was. It was a good car. And so I had I was in a car club, and we used to go to the drag strip down in Oceanside, or, you know, up in wherever it was, Bakersfield sometimes, that type of thing. And we had, in this car club, you had cars that showed and you had cars that go, and sometimes you had both, you know. And, well, I had one that went, and it was a 1966, a 1300, had a 1700 in it with a two-barrel. And this thing was a smoker on the street. It was a good street machine. And I said, okay, I'm in that. And I had a seatbelt. I had a three-point seatbelt, because when you go to the drags, you had to have a seatbelt. And that was the one night I didn't use it. And I'll tell you why in a minute, why that was good. Well, ordinarily, I'd say always wear your seatbelt. In this case, it was probably the best thing I didn't do. From Harbor Boulevard to Beach Boulevard, there's a street there, and I lived on Beach. And it's probably a couple, 2-3 miles in La Habra there, from Harbor to Beach. And the road does one of these. And this is about 1-2 o'clock in the morning. And I recall I was coming from Harbor, heading towards Beach, and I recall seeing a bunch of lights way off in the distance at the top of the hill. And I was up the other hill at the top, and I went down, and it went down, and, you know, didn't see it. And I'm kind of feeling a little woozy, so I rolled down the window. And the next thing I know, I'm waking up in the hospital. Now, the part about this is that they were moving this house. And where I hit it was at the corner of Idaho and Lambert. And at that corner was La Habra Hospital. And it took 2.5 hours to get me into the hospital, because they thought I was dead. And the fact of the matter is that what had happened was the support beam that was holding up one side of the house ripped the roof off my car. And where the windshield is supported and it meets the part of the door, that was ripped away. And that caught my head. Fortunately, I was leaning and I didn't have my seatbelt on. Otherwise, I would have been straight up and I would have been decapitated. This only happened because I was, you know, the jagged metal, it caught me. It was with such a velocity that the little Volkswagen Beetle, the engine was in the back seat. 2.5 hours to get me into the hospital because they thought I was dead. Now, something happened. They got me alive. They cleaned me up, sort of. Basically, what had happened was this thing had ripped me from here all the way to the back of my skull. And then there was glass and cuts and shards all over my face. And I had this lizard eye, you know. One eye was, I looked like a lizard. That was cool. Yeah. But the part of the story I always forget to tell is that at that time, my hair was about as long as Rick's. And when they went to sew me up, and they didn't use a lot of stitches, they just sewed me as quick as they could. They shaved my head on one side. So I had all this matted, blood-stained, soaked hair here. And on this side, I had a nice shaved head with stitches in it. I looked like a tackle box. You know? And then they wrap my head up and my eye and everything else, for crying out loud. If anybody has seen the old movies of Boris Karloff in The Mummy, that's exactly what I look like, with all this wrapping, you know, lizard eye. Oh, jeez. And it was pretty amusing. But that was the part I've always left out of that story, that how long my hair was and what had happened. They shaved it. I was setting a fashion statement 50 years before it became fashionable. The stupid things we do. I'm getting to the point where, you know, that accident caused me to go to court. Now we get to why he calls me Perry Mason. That is because when I went to court, I, as the wise, intelligent human being I thought I was, decided to defend myself. How do you think that worked out? The assistant DA, he pulled me aside because I'm sitting there. I didn't know what the hell they were doing, what was going on. And he pulled me aside and he says, look, I'll go easy on you. I'll do this, you know, this, and this. The fine was X amount of dollars. And I went, oh, shit, I can't pay that, you know. And you'll lose your license for a bit. Well, I can't do that. You know, and he goes, look, plead no contest because your blood alcohol count was 0.36. Now keep in mind, I'm 21 years old. I've been drinking for a long, long time. 0.36, 2.5 hours after I get into the hospital is when they measured this. So I just want to let you know, I was pretty tanked. And the fact of the matter is that, you know, I jumped through the hoops, I paid the fines, I lost my license for a period of time, I did everything. But what they did was they gave me this little card to go to these stupid meetings at Alcoholics Anonymous. And I went, why in the hell would I, all right, I'll do it. And this was a 9-month deal. I had to go through this for 9 months. And I went to the meetings and I got it signed off, and all I saw every time I went to the meeting was a bunch of old people who had to quit drinking. Old people. You know, 30, 40 years old. The fact of the matter is that I did the deed. I jumped through the hoops. I did the things that I was supposed to do, and I got my license back. I paid the fines. I owed a year for college, and oh God, it was a miserable time. Believe me, guys, it was. But as soon as I got all that stuff, I said, okay, I am out of here, and I went back out for 3 more years. Now the reason I came back 3 years later was because I had really run it until the wheels fell off. And I'm not going to go into that story. A few people have heard it. It's too long to go into. The fact is that what happened was I had to call somebody that I had met during that period of time at attending those meetings. And I said, I need help. I absolutely need help. I can't stop. And they were there almost as quick as they could drive there, they were there. And they talked me down, talked me through it, and took me to my first meeting. My first AA meeting was sitting in this guy's dining room at the dining room table, listening to a cassette of an AA speaker. For you young people, a cassette it was right after the 8-track, which was right after the 4-track, and it was before the CD. And now I guess they have something else, MP3 players or whatever they are. I don't know. I'm too old. I'm technology challenged, I guess. Anyway, long and short of it, I'm listening to this cassette. I didn't hear a word. I couldn't tell you who it was. I couldn't tell you. My head was going 1,000 miles an hour. It was everywhere. It was all over the place. It was like, here we go again. The youngsters probably won't remember the term pinball machine, but my head was like a pinball machine. I mean, it was just bouncing everywhere at that time. And the next night I went to a meeting, and I was a little clearer. Now, when I came into Alcoholics Anonymous, I came in as an atheist. I didn't believe in God. I didn't go to church. I didn't have that kind of background. I was an intellectual idiot, and I admit it, and I own it. But the fact of the matter is that when I went home that night, because my head was like virtually spinning out of control, I couldn't sleep. I had always used alcohol to pass out. I could not sleep. I'm laying there in the dark going, God, just let me, I have to go to work tomorrow. Let me go to sleep. And finally I just said, you know, and I was skeptical. I admit it. But I looked up into the darkness and I said, God, please help me. And the next thing I know, I woke up the next morning, got ready and went to work on time. What do you call that? Simple thing maybe to a lot of people, but to me, that was the sign I was looking for. It gave me a reason to believe in something bigger than myself. And at that time, all I could do was call it a higher power. And this higher power helped me on the beginnings of my journey. And, well, Albert and I were talking about it. Actually, an adventure in Alcoholics Anonymous. And he's right about that. It has been, and it continues to be, an adventure. And that higher power has guided me. And there's been times when I didn't think he was listening to me, you know. But he was there, and it was just me, you know. I expect him to wear a watch, and he doesn't. And, you know, I want things when I want them, you know. It's that type of thing. And a lot of us have learned these things through the course of time. And this is what I had to learn. And it was the beginning of Alcoholics Anonymous. And, you know, there was a point where I thought, well, maybe I'm too young, you know. And somebody reminded me that the only requirement for membership is that at that time it was an honest desire to stop drinking. And I had an honest desire, so I wanted to stop drinking. And I said, well, then I must not be too young. Now, when I got there in 1976, I was almost about 25, I think. And there wasn't a lot of young people there yet. And I'm not saying there was, like I believe the last time I was there, there wasn't a lot of what I would call old people, but there was. And, you know, and some of the oldest people were there, you know, somebody with like long-term sobriety, you know, 12 years, 16 years, 18 years, you know, this was long-term sobriety to me. But I was kind of an anomaly. I was not unique, okay, when I got here. There were other young people that had come in prior to my being there. And they were out there, but they were few and far between at that time. So, like I say, I wasn't unique, but I was an anomaly at the club that I went to. And that was in Whittier, California, at Serenity Hall. And at that time, it was located on Greenleaf Avenue. And they have since moved it over on Penn Avenue, not far from Whittier Boulevard. And I mentioned that because, I'll get to that in a minute, But those people guided me. And there was three, oh God, they were the sourest, dourest looking people I've ever seen in my, you know, they had that jailhouse scowl, you know, just, you know, sitting in the front row. And they were the old timers. Oh, criminy. You know. And sometimes the best thing they could tell me was, okay, that's fine, you know, because I'd stand up, I'd introduce myself, and they'd, that's fine, now sit down, shut up, don't touch nothing. You got nothing to share but the disease. We're here to hear about recovery. And I went, well, that's rude. I'm sorry, is my time up? No problem. Anyway, if it wasn't for those guys and learning from them and sitting at their feet and walking the path that they had blazed before me, I probably wouldn't be here today. You know, it was due to those people and people like them and people like yourselves in these rooms, rooms just like this, all over Southern California. Okay? But we're all here for the same purpose, and that's to stay sober one day at a time. And we talk about, you know, we talk about a lot of things here, and we learn a lot of things, how to live life on life's terms. And some of the new people struggle with that a little bit because they don't know how to deal with life on life's terms. But the fact of the matter is, it's right now. It's what you're dealing with at this moment. The next indicated thing is what's needed to be done. And these are the things that I've had to learn in this program. And the thing I love about this program, there's an old story out there, and many of you have probably heard it. Okay, but if you haven't, you know, if you have, bear with me, and if you haven't, that's fine. I want to tell it anyway, because it describes to me what the people in Alcoholics Anonymous are like. A man fell into a hole, and it was a deep hole. And all of a sudden, he looks up, and he sees his doctor, and he says, "Hey, Doc, I fell into this hole. I need help." And the doctor looked at him and wrote him a prescription and flung it down into the hole. And then the next thing he saw his reverend. And he says, "Hey, reverend, I fell into this hole. Can you help me out?" And the reverend, yeah, he wrote him a prayer and he flung it down into the hole. And the next thing you know is he sees his old buddy. And he hadn't seen him for a while. And he says, "Hey, man, how you doing? I fell into this hole. I need some help to get out of here." And the next thing you know, his buddy jumps down into the hole. He says, "What in the hell are you doing? Now we're both trapped down here." And his buddy says, "Yeah, but I've been here before, and I know the way out." That is what Alcoholics Anonymous people do. These are the things that happen to us through trial and error, through tragedy and happiness. You know, we're here and we support each other. We help each other. And that's what we try to do. No, none of us are perfect. We all have feet of clay. We're all going to fail at some point in time. And I accept that. I'm human, you know. And if I can accept it in me, then I sure as hell should be able to accept it in you, as that is what the program has given me, humanity. It has taken a guy who was the most unfeeling person in the world. I had no feelings. I could care less. I didn't care about you. I didn't care about dogs, cats, women, children. It didn't matter. It was, this heart was encased in a block or ice or whatever you want to call it. And this program has chipped away at that through the course of years and time and has allowed me to become, damn it, a human, a feeling human being who can empathize with the tragedies of other people, with the trials of other people, with the happiness of other people. You know, what cracks me up, I love it when somebody comes into somewhere, you know, in our fellowship here, I got my license, you know. That is a damn big deal. You know, and it really is. And I'm happy for them. And they need to get that. And they get their, I got a credit card. Well, I'm not so happy for you, but I want you to pay it, okay? You know. So these are the things, forgive me. These are the things that it has given me, you know. I have two children, and I was about 15 years sober when they were born, and I'm happy and proud, and the credit goes to God, not to me, but I'm happy and proud that my children have never seen their father drunk. They've seen him annoyed, but they've never seen him drunk. And I love my children to death. You know, my daughter, God, this is how much I know she loves me. Every time I see her, she goes, "Good morning, you bitter old bat." And I'm like, oh, God, that touches my heart. Now, they grew up with me as a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And there was a place I used to work at in Santa Ana. And you'd have to run out and get lunch at lunchtime because nothing else was there. And there was a 7-Eleven there. And I told them the story one day. Every day at the doors were the panhandlers. I know you guys have seen them, you know, but they're out there. You got any change? Got any change? Got any change? And like every day you go there and they see you, it gets a little old. You know, I'm like, God, man, you know, I've given you every dime I have. You know, now I can't give you anymore. So one day I pull up and I see these guys and they're standing up, getting ready to pounce. And as I got out the door, I looked at the first guy I saw. I looked him in the eye. I said, "You got any spare change, man?" Now, I bring that up because my daughter works down in Visalia. And she works over where there's a lot of the tinfoil hat crowd over there. You know? And she really has to, I have to commend her, you know, because the American public sometimes is really needy. You know, I mean, I myself have thought, you know, here's what you came in for. Yes, sir. Yeah, die in hell. You know, it's that, thank you, but get out of here. You know, it's one of those things. That's what she goes through all the time. And I bring that up because one day she was heading into work and one of the panhandlers stopped her. And he goes, and he didn't say he got any change. He just looked at her and he goes, "Change?" And she goes, "It comes from within." And she walked into the and she told me about this and I went, "God, you actually listen to me now." Wow, what a revelation. Anyway, I bring that up because, you know, they're the pride of my life, and I love them both. They're not perfect, but who is? You know, and they're straight and they're strong and they have a good work ethic, and I can't ask for more. You know, God has blessed me with two beautiful children. The program is what has given that to me. And, you know, and the program has blessed me with that. And if it wasn't for this, I don't know that they would have, you know, been that way. The dad, you know, I used to drink and, you know, we wanted to move the furniture out through the window when it was closed. And I was happy with that. And that's the way I was. You know, well, that's not the way I am these days. Okay? And it hasn't been for a long, long time. Contrary to speculation, they dropped the charges. I did not have to appear before the judge today. But I did want to say that, you know, it's because of this program, because of you people, and people like yourselves all over. Okay? I don't know how much time I have left. 5 minutes? Quick, one more quick story. I don't know how quick, but anyway. I hadn't had a vacation in a long, long time, and I had been sober 14, 15 years. And I decided, you know what, I really want to take a vacation. I met somebody from Germany, okay, and she had come over here. Of course, it's a she, but what else, you know? And I said, well, why don't I go over there? And she lived in the northern part of Germany, of a place called Bremen. And anyway, all I did was book airline tickets. I got a passport, I got some luggage, and I put it all together and I said, just get me over, I want to go to London, okay, for 4 days by myself. And I got into a bed and breakfast, I landed in London. And I was, you know, I was jet lag all over the place. I took a nap. And the very first thing I did was I called central office in London. And I said, where is there a meeting? I am at Gloucester and such. And he said, oh, it's over there on Thayer and Hind. And I went, oh, great. Okay. I don't know where Thayer and Hind is. I've never been to London, you know. Well, come to find out, everybody that lives in London doesn't know where Thayer and Hind is either. Now, the day I landed was the day that Saddam Hussein had invaded Kuwait. And in London, guess what they have a lot of? Middle Eastern people. And here I am in my Nike Air and my Levi's jeans and a camera slung around my neck. I couldn't have looked more Yankee than if I was waving the red, white, and blue. And here they are, and they're making noises, and they're shouting, and I'm trying to find the meeting. And I just kind of pass on through. I just walk on through. I ended up in Soho. And there's a police station there. And he got me, there was a map on the wall, and he showed me where it was, and it was actually, I wasn't that far from it. And I got there 5 minutes after the meeting had begun. And it was in the basement of the church. And you know what? It was an AA meeting. And it was just like the AA meetings that you've probably been to 1,000 times in your life. And it was a participation meeting. And it was great. It was great. And I went to him in Germany and ended up at a convention, an AA convention in Holland. Okay, it was Tiel, Holland. And there was about 600 people there at this hotel. And that was big. And what was amazing about it was the book of Alcoholics Anonymous had just been introduced to Russia about 2.5 years prior to that. And there was some people from Russia there. So I got to meet them. And these people were striving and heading, and they were having meetings, and it was just like AA Anywhere USA. So let me tell you, folks, it's all over the world. This program has really, you know, exploded into the world. It must be doing something right because it's lasted for about 82 years. And believe me, folks, I am grateful to each and every one of you. I have nothing but undying respect for anybody who is trying to stay sober one day at a time. And I hope that you do not leave before the miracle happens. And I hope you continue to come back. May God bless you and keep you. And thank you for allowing me to share.